there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 398. Quickly approaching that 400 mark. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com, stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is thisshowissogay, and of course, go on over to that Facebook. Type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. I have said this so many times over the years. One of my favorite things to do on this radio show is to feature incredible people doing incredible things, and we will be doing that again this week. Let me tell you about the Gender and Family Project at the Ackerman Institute for the Family in New York City. They have as their mission empowering youth, families, and communities by providing gender affirmative services, training, and research. Pretty important stuff. Here to talk all about it, Jean Maupas is the director of the Gender and Family Project. He's also the director of international training and a psychotherapist in private practice right there in New York City. He has presented on issues of gender, sexuality, addiction, couple and family therapy in the US, Israel, Chile, Argentina, Brazil, Belgium, and Canada. He has published several articles and chapters on his work with LGBT individuals, couples, and families, including the Family Process article called Between Pink and Blue, A Multidimensional Approach to Gender Nonconforming Children and Their Families. John is on the editorial board of the Journal of LGBT Family Studies and a board member of the American Family Therapy Academy. His leadership has been recognized by the First Early Career Award of the American Family Therapy Academy, and now he is here with us. Jean, bienvenue. Welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
We have so much ground to cover. Are you ready?
I am so ready, Ken.
Well, we have to start with you, of course. Why this path towards psychotherapy? What was the big moment where you said, this is what I was meant to do?
So it's a good question. So, you know, we have a sort of an insider's joke in the family therapy field. We say, you know, when you failed healing your own family, you try with others.
There you go.
So that's I think, what happens. You know, I actually knew from a very young age that I wanted to be a therapist. I don't think I exactly knew why, but it sort of was a calling. My mom was did a lot of social work and kind of told me a lot about her work, and it sort of got me interested in relationships, in families, and, you know, how people struggle and how people change and grow. So that was the dream.
I picture you as just being one of those Peanuts characters that has the booth with the 5 cents, come talk to Jean, growing up and all the kids told you their problems.
Almost. I, you know, when I was a kid, it was very kind of social, and we'd come back from the beach and I'd bring some shells, and we'd live near like a little bridge and sort of very kind of nice neighborhood area downtown in my hometown in Belgium. And I would take my shelves and a towel and go out on the bridge and sell them. And like people, friends of my parents would bring me back and say, oh my God, you can't let this child sell shelves on the street. Just because I wanted to talk to people. And I would sell them for like $1 million or $100,000. It was really fun.
It's fun to have a side gig like that. That's something to fall back on, Jean. That's not a bad thing.
Exactly.
It's a good thing.
Any day.
Now, you mentioned Belgium. You have the benefit of having all of this international experience. And you know, I think one of the struggles in a lot of the work that we do is having this very country-specific focus. Is doing this work of psychotherapy inherently different, doing it in different countries than doing it in the U.S.?
Well, you know, it's a good question. It's a hard question to answer in the sense of there's always sort of a culture of the field in each country. So, you know, I did undergrad and grad school in Belgium, which has a very kind of old school philosophy in psychotherapy. And I knew that I wanted to be a family therapist, and I knew about the Ackerman Institute actually in New York City from Belgium. And I knew, I sort of had my eye on it, and I wanted to come here because I always thought that therapists pathologize people too much. Mm-hmm. You know, that's sort of like we're looking for problems, we're looking for issues, we're looking sort of for like childhood issues that are still with us now. And I had a bit of a different take. I wanted to hear about people's resilience, strength, creativity, growth, and obviously the things that get in our way to grow, right? So I also thought like context was really important. So where we live, our race, our gender, our sexuality, sort of the community, the access that we have or not, felt really important and has an impact on our mental health, on how well we do. So that's why I came, in a way, to New York and to the Ackerman Institute, because I wanted to work from that perspective.
For folks who don't know about the Ackerman Institute for the Family, how would you go about describing it?
So the Ackerman Institute is a very special place. It's here in New York City. It was founded in 1960. It's actually the first family therapy training clinic that was founded in the U.S. and one of the only ones that has sort of survived and thrived over the years and the decades of different kind of schools of thoughts and the ins and outs of a family therapy. And it is a pretty big place with, we see about 500 families a month, with families coming from, I would say, the tri-state area around New York City. And then in addition to the clinic, we also do a lot of training. So we train everyone who has a degree and who wants to be a family therapist, who has a sort of graduate degree and wants to be a family therapist in our particular school of thought. So as I said, sort of a very resilient space, very sort of context-minded, looking in a way for the best in each family. And then in addition to that clinic and the training department, there are a bunch of special projects that are really based on what we feel the New York or even national community needs. So the Gender and Family Project is one of them. I founded it in 2010 because we found out that a lot of families of transgender children and adolescents actually did not have a place to go. So there were fantastic, groundbreaking programs for young people, for adolescents and young adults who identified as trans or questioning their gender. But very, very often, the family was not taken into account. So once we started working and children started coming out earlier, we really had to take into account the family. And we had to create a program that really helps everyone. So we have people here coming with their kid and the grandparents and the siblings. And, you know, we go into schools and communities. So it really is sort of a family approach.
And I know this is an extraordinarily basic question, but I want to hit that point even a little bit deeper. Why is it important to approach this type of work, which we'll dive into it a bit more but in a second, but why is it important to approach this type of work from a family perspective as opposed to, say, from an individual perspective?
Yeah, well, there is actually longstanding research that shows that family acceptance is actually one of the most effective protection for transgender youth and for LGBT youth in general. So there's great research that's been done for many years now out on the West Coast and other places in the U.S. showing that, for instance, a young person, a young LGBT-identified person who comes out of a family that is supportive has nearly 8 times less chances to want to commit suicide. So coming from an accepting family or having parents who will embrace, at least tolerate, be respectful, kind, and embracing of your identity actually really can be life-saving. So we were thinking, so what do you do when someone comes out at 5, at 10, at 12, and you need to make sure that they're going to grow up to feel strong and good about who they are and love themselves and be ready to face a world that can be dangerous. And we looked at sort of what families around us wanted, what they were saying, and we also looked at the research. And the research was, you know, showing it very clearly. We really need to help every family become gender inclusive and gender affirming. So we have this say, you know, when a child transitions, the entire family transitions along, and that's what we wanted to embrace and offer.
Holy cow, this work is important. What does the director of the Gender and Family Project do? What does that director title carry with it?
Oh, that's a good question. So the director...
That was supposed to be one of the easier questions, just so you know.
Oh, is it? Okay. No, so it's a lot of different things. We're really, really exciting, actually. You know, I was trained as a therapist.
Yeah.
Not trained as a manager, but what I'm learning is basically to take care of an entire team.
Yeah.
And take care of an entire program, and both have a vision. Think about, okay, where are we going? How do we grow? What does the community need? You know, what are our families and kids telling us, and what do we need to put in place? So, just to give you an idea, for instance, right now we have been really blessed to have young people and kids and families with us for the past 8 years. And so some of the kids, gender expansive and trans kids who are in this program have literally grown with the Gender and Family Project. We're a bit of a family, and they're now adolescents and they're about to go off to college, and job readiness is not easy. So we started with a play group, and then we opened a tween group, and then a teen group, and then a sibling group, a grandparent group, other kinds of group. And now we're in this place where we're like, okay, we need to help our young people access work and be ready for jobs. And when you know that it's not an equal playing field, that being trans and out at work or facing a world that, as I said, can be dangerous, you can have extra layers of anxiety. So right now, for instance, we're like looking at how do we develop a program that helps people take on the next step of their leadership, of their development. So it's a lot of things like that, sort of envisioning. And then, I have to be honest about this. It's also making sure that we raise the money and we raise the resources to be able to do the work that's really needed. So a lot of my work is about making sure that families are taken care of, that the team is taken care of, and that we can afford to do the work that we absolutely need to do.
How would you define that need? I mean, I would imagine that this work that we need to do is so much of what drives you all. How do you wrap your mind around what that need is?
You know, I mean, the first thought I had when you just said that, we did a little focus group with about 12 parents a couple weeks ago. And one of the dads in the program said to us, he said, my daughter, who is 12 and who is trans identified and was assigned male at birth and now socially transitioned and affirmed, my daughter came to me a couple months ago and she said, if you, and she was speaking to her family at the time, if you had not let me do this, if you had not supported me, and if we had not gone to these groups and therapy, I think I would have killed myself.
Yeah.
And that for me sort of summarizes it there. That's how the need is. That's how important it is. Like, if this doesn't exist, some kids won't make it. Some family members won't make it. It's just, that's where it starts.
Again, listeners, we are here with Jean Malpass, the director of the Gender and Family Project at the Ackerman Institute for the Family. Gender affirmative services. So what do gender affirmative services look like for you all?
Well, gender affirming means that we believe that you cannot make or break a child's gender identity. It basically is founded on the premise that, when you're born, someone assigns you a sex, or male or female, or intersex, and that doesn't mean it's that person's gender. The person's gender is something else completely different. For some of us, it's aligned with our sex assigned at birth, and for some of us, it is not. So in some way, what this means is that anatomy is not destiny, that gender is something that is self-defined. So that's the premise that we start with. So we do our therapy, we do our trainings for school, our training for mental health professionals are all based on this idea that we support children develop and grow, and we also believe them when they come to tell us and tell their family that they feel uncomfortable in the sex that they were assigned at birth. They feel maybe uncomfortable in the body that they have, or as they hit puberty, it feels their distress is increasing. It means that we will obviously do, a thoughtful, slow, family-based assessment to make sure that we get everybody's perspective, that we don't jump to any conclusions, because we also don't want to sort of fall back in a binary frame too easily. But ultimately, that we believe kids and that we believe that you can't make or break a child's gender identity.
So important. You know, I was kind of wrapping my mind around the work that you all do, and I think where I got a little bit stuck was, how do you go about defining the scope of your work, right? So obviously you have families who are coming in, and you're working individually with clients and with families, but then there's also the part where you're doing this really important work that has such a wider impact. How do you balance out individual work, family work, with more broad advocacy? Because obviously not every place is New York City, right? So you guys are providing services that should be available everywhere, but isn't. How do you go about looking at the scope? Does that make sense of how big
Absolutely.
This all is? Yeah.
I think you should be my coach.
Okay.
I really love your questions. It's like, what does it mean to be a director? How do you balance the scope? These are the great questions that we ask ourselves all the time. Look, listen, it's actually really sort of central what you're saying, because we are straddling a lot of different things in some ways. So, you know, we're here, we're a mental health clinic, so we provide family therapy. We do parental coaching. We do psychological evaluations with the kids who need them. So it's kind of very locally based. It's professional services. And then it's like, imagine concentric circles. And then there's another circle around it that's community. And these are our groups. So our philosophy is that not every family or every kid needs therapy at all. What they need is a peer group.
Right.
You know, other kids who are like them and grow up and feel like, I'm not the only one in the world who feels the way I do. I have many friends who are like me. And, you know, it's one of the first generations, you know, in the trans community that has really grown with a peer group from a very, very early age. The same applies to the families. Parents who are cisgender identified, so who don't identify as transgender and who are raising trans kids or gender expansive kids, often feel really sort of at a loss. That's not their experience. That's not their map of the world. They didn't even know they were cisgender until, you know, they discovered that word, and they also need a peer group.
Right.
They need other folks who sort of like have the same questions, the same fears, the same battles and the same, you know, achievements. And then another concentric circle is like those families interface with the world all the time, school, hospitals, therapists, community, you know, place of faith. And who helps them there, right? Does the help stop at the group and we say just, you know, best of luck and face the world on your own? No, we felt like we couldn't do that. So we offered our assistants to do some training. So we go into, as family will say, you know, our school really means well, but they don't know how to introduce to a class the fact that my child is going to go from female to male pronoun middle of the year. How do I do this in second grade? How do we talk to the parents? How do other parents understand this and understand that it's not a threat to their kid, that it's actually a good thing, that their kid is going to learn to be inclusive and respectful and a good citizen? So, you know, the help just could not stop at that community level. We had to go take on training. And then when you do that, what we've also found out is that it's not just local. So we are co-sponsoring a regional conference with the Hedrick Martin Institute and PFLAG. And every year we have nearly 1,000 family members and kids and professionals who come from all around the East Coast because they do want to learn this way of working, a gender inclusive approach. So, you know, we go where we're needed, and it fuels us. It's a beautiful, beautiful feeling.
I was going to ask, what does Jean get out of this work?
You know, we just had a team meeting an hour ago, and we were all saying like how tired we were and how good it was to have had a weekend. But I was thinking, you know, I've run the parent support group since 2008. Every month on Friday night, once a month. I've missed two of them since 2008, every month.
Wow.
Because I was, you know, sort of ill with fever in bed. And I was thinking there's very few other things that I've done so sort of, I would say, religiously or passionately, because it feeds me. I feel really blessed to be in that room. I know sometimes we have 20 to 40 parents who come in, also who have been coming for years, and who are just trying to be their best self, their best parent, who are trying to make room for their own anxiety, to support their kids to face the world, and not just face the world, but change the world. So it's an amazing energy that I, you know, that feeds me too.
Let me do the flip side of that, because we cannot have these conversations. I refuse to have these conversations on this radio show. As a college professor, I need to highlight, as I do with my students, talk to me about self-care. Because as much as you guys are doing incredible work with these families, and I know they are so appreciative, there's also the piece where we want to make sure that you guys are taking care of yourselves as well.
Oh, that's very sweet. Thank you. Well, we try. I think, you know, I think it's well known, at least in our field, that sometimes, you know, in the social work field, in the therapy field, it's we're dealing with a lot of emergencies. We're dealing with a lot of sometimes life or death circumstances. And so saying no, you know, saying, no, I can't do this today, or I can't respond to this, is not always easy. But I think that what we've learned is that our team support is really essential. We need to support each other. So we have these regular team meetings. We have these conversations. We check in on each other. We, you know, give each other time off. We do retreats. We talk about other things. You know, we make sure to have fun. We make sure to, you know, I think a lot of wonderful friendships have been born out of this work, because you can't do this work, you know, day and night without getting really close. And,
right.
I couldn't do this alone. Like, so having friendships and having time off to just live and you know, walk around is really nice.
Yeah. And to have lovely evenings. And one of those lovely evenings will be Monday, April 24th, 2017. It will be the Night of a Thousand Genders. Tell our listeners about the Night of a Thousand Genders.
We are so excited for Night of a Thousand Genders. It's coming soon, a couple of days. And it is our annual gala. So it is the fourth year that we put it together. And so as I said earlier, you know, part of my job and part of our responsibility to our families is to raise money to make sure that this program can run, right? And so we, four years ago, we decided that it would be really good to do this in a way that's fun, that's not you know, just a fundraiser and it, get the job done. That's great, that's important, but we also wanted it to be a night of celebration, a night of honoring everyone. And so for the fourth year, we put together an amazing concert. We have awards. We have four or five performers, most of them LGBT identified or ally identified. And we have fun. And that's the first part. And then after, we have an after party, which is at least as much of fun as well, with DJ Lena Bradford and our hosts, Lady Deja and D. Tranny Bear, and they're amazing. So we're looking forward to it. So it's a night of fun, a night of celebration. We're very, very excited this year to have amazing performers. We have the Youth Bright Chorus here from New York, so a lot of young, talented people who are going to be performing with us. Katie Couric, who did an amazing job with the Gender Revolution with National Geographic, will be there with us and support the cause. Our host is Dominique Jackson. She is one of the stars on the show Strut on Oxygen, produced by Whoopi Goldberg. And then we're really excited to honor two amazing teams. So one is Jill and Faith Soloway, the creators and writers of Transparent, the show, which we're really, really excited to have. And the other one is Sean Coleman, who is the director of Destination Tomorrow, which is a trans center in the Bronx here in New York City. So, you know, meaningful stuff and fun stuff.
I feel like you already have your outfit picked out.
How can you tell? How can you tell? What do you think it's going to be?
Listen, I'm not going that far into this. You're the psychotherapist, but I just would like to point out that I feel it is picked out. I think there's a color scheme to it, and it's quite tailored. I'm thinking it's quite tailored.
You're very close. You're very close. Imagine, think blue and black.
There you go. There it is. There it is. You know, you mentioned how long the Gender and Family Project has been around, you know, 7-8 years and been doing this work. I would imagine that one of the challenges is that the terminology changes, new research comes out. How do you go about staying current on everything that's happening?
So first, we have a research department. So we do our own research, but we also are constantly sort of looking at the literature that comes out, what other teams and colleagues are doing throughout the country and I'd say around the world. So sort of this exchange of information and sort of keeping up to date is a really important part of the work. And then the other thing is, I think that the conversation about gender and what gender is and what it means for each of us to have a gender is evolving over time. It's in itself, in a way, a social conversation. It's a construction that we're all a part of. And so we listen. We listen to what each of us say and feel. We listen to what the team is saying. We listen to what the families are saying. The young people are teaching us new things, every week. And we try to honor the language that feels the most, I'd say, up to date in terms of research, but also affirming and celebratory for our young people.
Yeah. For all of those families who are listening in or people who are connected to families who might want to access services but are not necessarily in the tri-state area, what is your message for families out there? Because we know, look, we would love it if we could clone you and there could be a Gender and Family Project and an Ackerman Institute for the Family everywhere, but we know that that's not the case right now. What message do you put out there to families who might not have the same access to resources?
Well, I'd say a few things. One is acceptance is protection. So that's our mantra, and we've been saying this, and we've been really believing in this from the beginning. You know that even if you're struggling as a parent or as a family member to do your own work, to be able to make room for your feelings, to find a community of peers, even if it's online, there are lots of Facebook groups, of private Facebook groups that will help parents and family members sort of have peers and have conversations that helps them. So don't stay alone. Don't work alone. Understand that being accepting is going to make a world of a difference for your kid and for the young person. And it's going to make them stronger. It's going to make them ready to face a world that, you know, can be difficult. Often what we found out is that parents and caregivers and family members are not rejecting because they don't love their kids. They're rejecting because they think it's the best way to be protective.
Right.
They think, you know, look, it's going to be too hard a life. I don't want this for you. And they don't think about the possibilities. They don't think about success and achievements and health. And by being accepting, they're going to have a much stronger child. So don't stay alone. Find a group. Find a community of peers. Remember that acceptance is protection. And remember that we all have a gender.
I give you the last word. One of my favorite things to put out there for people who are in positions such as yours. I know you just had a team meeting. I know you are not setting out on this work alone. Extol for our listener audience. Tell everybody about the wonderful staff that you are working with there at the Gender and Family Project.
They are the most amazing. We have this hashtag that says best team ever. That's sort of, we text each other when we need that. I have an amazing team. So Benjamin Davis is our deputy director and is doing a lot of amazing work with schools and training professionals. And we have a great person who does our development and communication, Jane Rennert. And then we have, you know, nearly 12 to 15 therapists and trainers who meet with family every day, who run groups every week, who go to school every day. And, you know, this could not happen without them. They're absolutely changing the world, each of them.
There it is. There it is. Listeners, this is what we need you to do right this very second. Go on over to ackerman.org. That's ackerman.org/GFP. GFP. That's the Gender Family Project. ackerman.org/GFP. You can learn all about the Gender and Family Project, all the important work that they are doing there. I am feeling pretty darn confident that John will be okay if you click that donate button and support their work financially in addition to learning about what what they're doing. And of course, on Monday, April 24th, 2017, at the City Winery, 155 Varick Street. Oh my gosh, do I miss Varick Street. The Night of a Thousand Genders. Night of a Thousand Genders, Monday, April 24th. Jean, you guys are doing such important work, and I'm so happy that we got to talk about the scope, because I know that the families that you're working with are so appreciative, and you are changing lives in that way, but you're also doing that critically important work of role modeling for the rest of us what we can accomplish when we have these conversations, and it is a most inspiring thing.
Thank you so much for your support, Ken. It means a lot to us.
Everybody, Ackerman.org/GFP. Jean, keep doing what you're doing.
Thanks.
All right, folks, and we are back. So if you think that the work from the Gender Family Project is the only important work that we're covering on this week's episode, holy rainbows, are you wrong? There is a new campaign out there called the Eliminate Hate Campaign. It's a partnership between many organizations and spearheaded by Media Matters for America, the web-based nonprofit Progressive Research and Information Center dedicated to comprehensively monitoring, analyzing, and correcting conservative misinformation in the U.S. media. Here to talk about all of these efforts is Erin Fitzgerald. She is the LGBT Program Director at Media Matters. She has previously worked at the Williams Institute at UCLA School of Law, at the Red Umbrella Project as their research and policy director, and at the National LGBTQ Task Force. Right this second, though, she is here with us. Erin, welcome to this show with So Gay.
Thank you so much.
We have a lot of ground to cover, Erin. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Well, we have to start with you. What would you say is the narrative thread that traces our listeners through Erin Fitzgerald's work? You've worked at so many different places. What's the narrative thread that carries you through?
You know, I really love research. I love being able to access knowledge and then utilize it to affect change. And so I really got to start working on that when I was at the National LGBTQ Task Force. I worked on the National Trans Discrimination Survey, and that was a groundbreaking survey that was published in 2011 that was the largest survey sample of trans folks in the United States. And that survey just really took off, and getting to experience that was something that I wanted to be doing forever. So I decided to make a go of being a researcher and statistician, and so that's how I ended up at UCLA and then Media Matters after that.
As a college professor, if there's anything you can say to my students to encourage them to research more, that'd be great, Erin. Go for it.
You can't expect the world to change if you don't have the information to back up what you're asking for.
So important. So important. And we should highlight there are any number of people who are out there who have a soapbox who don't necessarily have the research backing them up. This is important stuff.
It is. It's incredibly important. I think two people in this tide of extremism feel a little bit disempowered, and knowledge is such a great way to empower yourself and such a great way to feel like you have autonomy and authority over the direction of your life or the lives of your community.
Nice. This is a little bit Erin Fitzgerald, This Is Your Life, but I do want to talk about one project that you worked on, one paper, because I've actually referenced it before. When you were at the task force, you wrote up this paper, No Golden Years at the End of the Rainbow, How a Lifetime of Discrimination Compounds Economic and Health Disparities for LGBT Older Adults. Holy cow, do we need to be talking about that, Erin?
That is the longest title. It's true. I think we don't really realize, you know, that the tides of LGBT rights have changed so much in the last 10 years, but we have a generation of older adults who are the largest generation of people living with HIV and AIDS, the largest generation of people that have experienced systemic discrimination throughout their entire lives, and we don't really have the infrastructure to support them as they age and start to retire. You know, the baby boomers are starting to do that now, and you know, we're still fighting for basic rights as an LGBTQ community, let alone to have these specialized, you know, retirement homes or nursing facilities that are LGBTQ competent, which is such a hard task even for any medical provider, let alone specialized. And
yeah.
So really, the older adults are experiencing the largest brunt of that discrimination, and nobody really talks about it.
I thought your conclusion in that paper does so well to do exactly what you just said before about combining research with activism and really bolstering the work that we do. You wrote in that, in order to truly address all of the needs of the LGBT community, we must address the issues of LGBT elders and work to provide all LGBT people equitable and competent health care, wages, and access to opportunity. In order to do that, we must develop a multifaceted approach to ensure that LGBT people in all stages of their lives have access to fair treatment in all arenas. And it strikes me, Erin, that without solid research, we wouldn't be able to say that so strongly.
No, we wouldn't. I think that's exactly right. You need the research to back it up. You know, we all experience discrimination, but that can be easily written off as a one-off. People don't buy into microaggressions when you try and talk about them. They think it's, you know, a rare instance. But it's not true. We all know that's not true. You just have to have the numbers. You know, if you want to win hearts and minds, you have to win minds.
Yeah, there it is. No. There it is. So let's talk about Media Matters for America. I gave the quick soundbite about the organization in the intro. What brought you to Media Matters?
You know, I was, I'm a traditional researcher. I come from a very wonky background, and the election was impending, and I was feeling like the work that I usually do, like the work I did at Williams, you know, you work on a project for a year, and maybe it's published at the end of a year, but I wanted to be able to engage with the landscape in a more rapid response way. And I wanted to be able to do research that had a quick turnaround, that had meaningful impact right away, because I felt the imminency of what was happening. And that's how I landed at Media Matters, which has been a really amazing experience. I don't come from a journalism background, so I got to learn a lot of new things, but use a skill set that I've been practicing for a while.
I love it. Now, I'm going to call you out, which I don't normally do with my guests. Your title is LGBT Program Director, but I've been looking at a lot of what you've put out there. It strikes me it's much more intersectional than that.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I think, you know, as a woman, there's that intersectionality, the particular misogyny that femmes experience in the LGBT community. But we've also, since I've started, the other program, the issue program directors, and I have been focusing on developing more collaborative relationships, is with our reproductive rights program director, as well as education, because of the way that policy plays out. It never really just touches one issue area.
Gosh, why aren't we doing more of that intersectional work?
I ask that every day.
Yeah, I bet. Okay, so let's talk about the Eliminate Hate campaign. Where the heck did this come from? We need it, and we need it badly.
So this came from a project that we started this time last year. When you monitor the media every day, you notice these micro trends and you start to develop hunches. And we noticed that in any given news cycle, that anti-LGBTQ hate groups were never labeled in media publications, or at least it seemed infrequent to us. Whereas other extremist ideologies, you know, generally that label is included. And so we did what good researchers do, and we did a study. And we looked at top publications, and we found that publications use SPLC's designation for all other extremist ideologies, but rarely, if ever, used it for anti-LGBT hate groups.
Wow. Yeah, you found that over half a decade of research shows that journalists, more often than not, fail to identify anti-LGBTQ hate groups as such. So we have to do our two-part question here. First, why is that happening? And then second, why is it important that these anti-LGBTQ hate groups be designated as such?
I wish I understood why it was happening. I think a lot of the pushback, particularly at the anti-LGBTQ hate groups, is that people think that SPLC designates them as such because of their biblical views on marriage, or because they aren't comfortable with trans kids and their kids sharing bathrooms together. And that's actually not true. There's three things that trigger an SPLC designation. If an organization engages in serial misinformation or spreads malicious lies with the intention of denying people rights, or engages in incendiary and inflammatory name-calling, or attempts to criminalize LGBTQ people, which I think, you know, are three fairly stringent benchmarks, and I think that we could all agree that those are pretty heinous things to be doing.
Yeah. And so, with a campaign like this, how do we set out to do this?
Well, I think it's multi-pronged, really, because these anti-LGBTQ hate groups are very good at coordinating with one another, and they've been doing this for a long time, sort of under the radar. There are groups like the American Family Association and Alliance Defending Freedom who operate under the guise of being conservative Christian organizations, and that's actually not true at all. They're, you know, mega organizations that have a lot of funding, and they sort of obfuscate their true intentions by using this religious freedom language. After marriage equality passed, they sort of regrouped and came out with a new strategy, and that's around privacy, and that's around religious freedom. And really, it's just cloaked discrimination. Yeah. And so their talking points are very valid. They sound very believable. So if you are, you know, in middle America, if you're my mom or dad and you hear them on ABC or CBS, you're going to not understand the context of the work that they've done previously. You know, ADF is a big proponent of the criminalization of LGBTQ people, and they've been for decades.
I think that some of our listeners out there need to maybe be reminded, and maybe I'll speak from the eye, oh, that's right, these organizations actually do have sway over a wide swath of Americans out there.
They do, because their talking points are very much centered around personal beliefs and religion, and they're not outright homophobic in the way that they used to be. They've really streamlined and savvied up around their communication strategy, and they've used the media as a battleground for that.
So again, okay, so you're a researcher and you like your metrics. How do we measure if we've been effective in this campaign?
Well, I think what I'd like to see is that these publications already use SPLC as a subject matter expert for what constitutes hate and extremism, and all we're asking them to do is to give the same treatment to anti-LGBTQ hate groups that they give every other hate group.
And so what will that do? This is what I feel like sometimes we have to break it down for our listeners, because I see it, and then I'm thinking, that's right, if we designate them as such, here are some of the effects this could have.
Well, I mean, for one, it gives people the context and information that they need. If you just call them conservative or just call them Christian, that does a disservice to both conservatives and Christians to conflate the extremism that these groups engage in while under a different name. So one, it's important to provide that context, but two, it's important to know the history of those organizations, and so you really can't understand the true nature of their intentions if you don't know that, you know, these groups have worked internationally to pass some of the worst criminalization laws that you could imagine, like in Belize, like in Uganda.
Then that begs the question. So I believe that every campaign is going to be successful. I'm living in that world today. And so we're successful and we have these groups designated as such. Should they then, what voice should they then have on the national stage? Or should it be that any time they are quoted, it should be highlighted, this is designated as a hate group?
One, that we would like for them to always be designated as a hate group.
Yeah.
And two, I think, you know, journalists rely on false equivalents to tell both sides of the story, when sometimes if you have to rely on a hate group for the false equivalents or to present both sides, then maybe it's not an issue that's worth presenting both sides on.
Right. There it is. Because it doesn't have to be objective in that way, because it's not objective if you're working with a hate group.
Exactly. Exactly right. And I think really pushing home the truly insidious nature of these organizations is important for lots of different reasons. And ideally, businesses would question whether or not they would work with them. They wouldn't be able to garner the same sort of resources and support that they would if they were a conservative or a Christian organization.
Now, Media Matters for America is partnering up with the National Center for Transgender Equality, the National LGBTQ Task Force, Soul Force, the Equality Federation, the Matthew Shepard Foundation. Why is it important that all these organizations be working together on this?
Well, because these other organizations are doing the same thing.
Yeah.
So we have to, you know, fight fire with fire. We need a strong coalition, because I think there's really multitudes of experiences in the LGBTQ community. And so there's certain organizations like National Center for Transgender Equality that have a particular impact, like the bathroom bills that ADF has worked on in several states, or the National LGBTQ Task Force has a religious roundtable. And so that's talking about the voices of progressive faith leaders and making sure that they're represented when talking about religious freedom as well.
Yeah.
With the Shepherd Foundation, actually, the Shepherd family was targeted by ADF after Matt was attacked and murdered for, you know, they called his murder a hoax. They said that, you know, LGBTQ people were capitalizing on it.
Right.
They really attacked his character after he had been murdered, and that is just such a heinous thing to do to a mother.
Right.
Can you imagine? The Shepherd Foundation is important because it shows that it's not just words. There's real-life impact for the sort of hate and fear-mongering that these groups engage in.
Yeah, there it is. There it is. What can our listeners do? I think with a campaign like this, we just want to all say, great, media, everybody, designate these as hate groups. How can our listeners get involved to use their voices to make a difference?
Well, as you know, I'm a big advocate of everybody starting a blog. I think that it really helps to hone your voice and hone your experience. I really encourage people to write and research and read as much as possible. But I think the national climate feels sometimes daunting. But there's so much change to be made in local arenas, to be more involved in communities, to be more involved with local journalists. You know, these groups operate on very small microcosms. And so anybody in a small community, like ADF might be at a school board meeting. That's why it's important to be engaged with local politics. And that's why it's important to have like a broad swath of people that have, you know, vested interest in making sure that hate groups are, you know, inoculated and mitigated as much as possible. And they can do that by being more involved in their local areas because there's so much room to be made in state legislatures, in local government for pro-LGBTQ policy.
More involved, more informed. Listeners, this is what we need you to go do. You can learn more about Media Matters for America by going to mediamatters.org, and you can learn all about the great work that they are doing. And to get involved with this Eliminate Hate campaign, just go to eliminatehatecampaign.com. That's eliminatehatecampaign.com. Erin Fitzgerald is the LGBT program director at Media Matters. I love that you are a researcher. It is so, so important because it undergirds and supports so much of the change that we are all trying to enact. And you really are buttressing that change. And it's such important work, Erin.
Thank you so much. It feels important. And I'm glad to be able to do it.
Everyone says that I could do much better. Better than what, hey, I should go as GoPro. Bulletproof, 100, your favorite alcohol. She said too much of a good thing, it will kill you. You're cheaper than a rack of stolen jackets. A parody of someone else she'd like to be. You speak of Deepak Chopra.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, not a ton of time left on this week's episode, but we can still get to some of the latest LGBTQ news stories that are out there. All of this week's stories come to you from pinknews.co.us. Pink News giving us the latest in LGBTQ news. Alabama's disgraced Chief Justice has now lost his appeal against his suspension after he abused his powers in an anti-gay crusade. After the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in favor of equal marriage last summer, Alabama's Chief Justice Roy Moore tried to actively disregard the rulings. He issued a number of judicial orders to officials in his attempt to re-ban gay weddings. He declared that the Supreme Court rulings don't apply in Alabama. Again, this was Alabama's Chief Justice Roy Moore, who at one point said that the United States Supreme Court rulings, they don't apply in Alabama, which makes me a little bit nervous for whatever law school he went to and which classes he decided to ignore. But he learned the hard way that you can't actually ignore the highest court in America. The Judicial Inquiry Commission launched action against him for his string of illegal orders, alleging that he, quote, flagrantly disregarded and abused his authority. He was then suspended by the Court of the Judiciary until the end of his term. And just this week, he lost his Alabama Supreme Court appeal against the decision. He was represented in his appeal. I mean, they just keep coming up over and over by these same law firm that represented Kim Davis. That would be the Liberty Council. They are making their living off of representing anti-gay people, which is, wow, you're going to stake your claim on something. That is certainly something on which to state your claim. Anti-LGBT chief Matt Staver attacked the ruling. He said this, quote, "This opinion and the entire case against Chief Justice Moore is a tragedy. For the first time in the history of Alabama, a justice has been disciplined for issuing an administrative order. Under this system, no judge is safe to issue orders or render dissents." Well, that's not actually true, Matt Staver. Sure, justices out there can issue orders or render dissents, but not if it contradicts the actual law. The actual law. So there you go. Former Chief Justice Roy Moore tried to appeal his decision. He was suspended. He remains suspended. But not the only Alabama story out there this week. The governor of Alabama is being urged to veto a bill which would protect anti-LGBT adoption agencies which refuse to place children with gay parents. The bill, HB 24, was passed by the Alabama Senate this week. It would protect adoption agencies that claim that religious beliefs mean they can't place children with gay couples. And so the goal is to stop the state from refusing to license them. Again, this is what we're spending time on in the great state of Alabama, not placing children in homes, you know, children who desperately need homes. That's not what we're focusing our time on. We want to limit the number of qualified homes, apparently, into which these children can be placed. The sponsor of this bill, Republican Senator Bill Hightower, he claimed that the bill would protect the agencies and allow them to continue to place children in, quote, appropriate homes. That's what he's saying, appropriate homes. Apparently, though, he did not realize the irony of this next statement. He said this, quote, "The need for adoption is so high, we need to have every avenue available." That's truly what he said. The need for adoption is so high, we need to have every avenue available. Yes, Republican Senator Bill Hightower of Alabama, that means not limiting the number of qualified homes into which children can be placed. I don't think he got it. I don't think he got that one. The legislation has been criticized by Democratic senators and the Human Rights Campaign. They say it is thinly veiled discrimination. I don't even think it's thinly veiled. I think it's pretty outright. Senator Roger Smitherin said this, quote, "It isn't in the best interest of the child to deny them a qualified, loving family simply because that family doesn't share all of the tendencies of the placing agency's faith." Let me read that again. That is Senator Roger Smitherin. He said this, quote, "It isn't in the best interest of the child to deny them a qualified, loving family simply because that family doesn't share all of the tendencies of the placing agency's faith." Again, we're talking about the faith of the placing agency, not the faith of the child, the faith of the placing agency. That's a whole different thing. Eva Kendrick, the HRC Alabama state director, said this, quote, "Plain and simple, HB 24 is discrimination dressed up as a solution to a fake problem. It creates an unnecessary hardship for potential LGBTQ adoptive or foster parents in Alabama and primarily harms the children looking for a loving home. It's unfortunate that leaders continue to push this bill, even as child welfare organizations, faith leaders, and fair-minded Alabamians are standing up and calling this bill out for what it is, discrimination. We now ask Governor Kay Ivey to not sign into law this harmful bill." The only out gay legislator in Alabama, Representative Patricia Todd, said that she thinks that those backing the legislation aren't familiar with LGBT people and the issues they face. Representative Todd said this, quote, "They make an assumption that all of us would be bad parents. We are still at this point where we have folks just assuming that gay people would just be bad parents because we're gay." Other states like South Dakota, Michigan, North Dakota, and Virginia have already passed similar legislation. This is what we're focused on this year. I know people are thinking, well, marriage equality is a settled issue. Okay, certainly I would hope so, even though some states are still trying to write it into their constitution so as to circumvent the U.S. Supreme Court, which they could very well be inspired by the former Chief Justice there in the great state of Alabama, Roy Moore. But it's also things like this, not just bathroom bills, not just marriage equality, but also making sure that gay parents are not able to adopt in the same way straight parents can. You gotta be freaking kidding me. Ridiculous. Ridiculous. Happier news. Beauty and the Beast had glances implications in a short same-sex dance. Power Rangers had a quick throwaway comment about a female superhero's girlfriend problems. Well, Marvel's new film promises a lot more. The Black Panther, which is to be released in February of 2018, which I could not be more excited for, well, apparently there is some significant LGBT content in that film. In a scene laden with implications, Black Panther's team of female bodyguards dances with each other, and apparently there's some flirting. We like some flirting there. Now, why is this important, right? It's important because, first of all, the superhero industry, right this second, is huge. It's absolutely huge. And again, it reaches a segment of our population that other content doesn't reach, in the same way that gamers, when there's content in the gaming industry, that reaches a whole different segment of the population. Beauty and the Beast reaches a whole different segment of the population. So the more and more LGBT content is integrated into all this different media, the more people it reaches. I will speak from the eye. I would have been so inspired as a complete and utter comic book nerd to have been able to access LGBT content growing up. That would have been incredible for me. So I'm excited. I'm even more excited now for the Black Panther movie that's coming out next year. Apparently, there's some LGBT content in there. Two quick Oprah stories for you. Do you want the good or the bad first? Let's do the bad first. On the bad side of things, Oprah Winfrey's new reality TV star has a history of homophobia. John Gray, a Christian pastor from Houston, Texas, has been given an 8-episode documentary series by the Oprah Winfrey Network called The Book of John, which will follow his life as a preacher and family man. But apparently, he has quite the history of homophobia. He tweeted in 2013 that homosexuality is no different from fornication, adultery, lying, or any other sin. So he said that. In 2012, he attacked gay judge Tanya Parker for refusing to perform marriages until gay marriage was legal in Texas. He wrote this quote, "Gay judge in Texas refuses to do weddings until there's marriage equality. Let a straight or Christian judge try the opposite. They'd fire them." And he's got all of these different comments. And apparently he was given a show by the Oprah Network. And there's a lot of people not happy about that. So that's our not happy Oprah story. But in a happy Oprah story, Ellen DeGeneres is celebrating with Oprah. They had a big get-together because it has been 20 years, I can't believe it, 20 years since Ellen came out on Oprah as well as on her sitcom Ellen, 1997. Look how much has changed since 1997. This is such a good thing. It's so great to look at the progress of our community, but again, we have to remind ourselves there is still so much more work to do. Conversion therapy is still legal. We have all of these states saying, no, you couldn't possibly be placed foster child with a gay family. That would not be okay with us. Blood donation, gay men. There's still a deferral, a year deferral on gay men giving blood. And certainly everything that's happening with bathrooms, there's still so much more work to do. So we applaud Ellen and how much we have changed as a community and how much our society has changed in the past 20 years. But we must recognize there is more work to do. That's it. That's all the time we have for this week's episode. You guys know what to do. You got to get out there. You need to go use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBTQ brothers and sisters, for all of our allies out there. And while you're out there using your voice, while you're out there making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?